Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome. I just, before we start, want to thank the sponsors of today's shiur. We actually have two yahrzeits sites we are commemorating. My in-laws, Barbara and Aubrey Abram, are sponsoring an observance for yahrzeit of Aubrey's mother, Leila, and Sandra Welks is observing yahrzeit for her father, Avram Wintman, Avram Tzvi Ben Yitzchak. Ben Yitzchak Chaim, the neshama should have an aliyah. And as we were talking, I just want to wish all good long life, and we should have happy occasions to celebrate. Thank you. Okay, we're up to Mishnah 17 or 18. We ended off last week. We were discussing sort of the contradiction: what's better, this world or the next world? On the one hand, this world is the only place you can do mitzvot, and the Mishnah says it's better 1 hour of mitzvot and masim tovim in this world is greater than the entire world to come. And yet, on the other hand, the Mishnah says that the world to come, 1 hour of peace and tranquility in the world to come, is better than this entire world. Now, of course, we began to explain that it sounds like a contradiction, and perhaps on one level it is, but we said these really, the two worlds, they're not contradictory in the sense that they have two totally different goals. So, you know, when you're in this world, the only purpose, this mitzvot, is Torah mitzvot. Nachat ruach, and that's not for this world. This is not the world to relax. I know the Welks and the Wintman family were very close to Rav Soloveitchik in Boston, and the Rav always would comment, you know, this is not the world for peace and tranquility. That's why God got so mad at Yaakov Avinu. He wanted to relax at the end of his life. Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Megurei Aviv. And God said, no way. That was, and then the whole Yosef story began. Only in the next world can a person relax. So from that point of view, the relaxation in the next world is better than this entire world. But in this world, next world, you have no opportunity to mitzvot. The two categories, Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, are very different. We mentioned we don't really understand what Olam Haba is about. The Torah doesn't talk about it. Our goal is to worry about Olam Hazeh. Olam Haba comes as a byproduct, so to speak, from our actions in this world, but that's not our concern. So each one has its own separate category. Okay, that's just a little review, a little add-on. Okay, so the Mishnah continues. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer. This is Mishnah 18 in my categorization of mitzvot, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Al teratzeth chavercha b'shat kaso, v'al tenachmenu b'shat shemei tom mutal lefaneha. You should not try to appease a friend when he's angry. You should not try to comfort them when the dead is lying before them. Meitom mutal lefanav. Al tishal lo b'shal nidro. You should not ask him when he makes a vow, ask him any details about the vow. And here it's interesting. Do not try. Do not try and see him when he's degradation, you should not try to see him. So let's try to unpack this a little bit. So Rav Shimon Elazar, he's one of the later Tanaim. He's a student of Rav Meir, a contemporary of Rav Yehuda HaNasi, the sixth and final generation of the Tanaim. So the Mishnah is, obviously all these things are very important. You want to comfort people. You want to appease people. You want to help them out, but the person has to do it in the right place. If you do it in the wrong time, it can actually backfire. So obviously, if you try to appease somebody when he's angry, he just gets angrier. You have to let people let off steam. That's a very important idea. We don't always do that, but one has to let person be angry, and when it gets over his anger, that's the time to tell him to relax. But tell him to relax and to calm down when they're in the midst of anger is A, it's not going to work, and B, it's make the situation a lot worse. It's interesting, the Bartanura, he traces many of these teachings to God himself. And the Talmud, a very anachronistic teaching, tells us that after Cheta Egel, how do we know this? Because after the sin of the golden calf, God said he's departing from the Jewish people. He cannot be with them anymore. He agreed he will not destroy the Jewish people, but he can no longer walk with them and be with them in the desert. And Moshe pleaded with God to come with them and to be with them as they take their journey towards Eretz Yisrael. They build a Mishkan. And God sent Panay Elehu, I will go with you, but leave me for now, and I'll come with you eventually. And the rabbis interpret the verse to mean Panay, sort of a face of anger. When my anger subsides, then you can talk to me about it. But now is not the time, but I will come with you eventually. Now, all these teachings, when the Gemara has all these teachings about God, so this is on the one, the Ravid has a famous critique of the Rambam. The Rambam, we know, and one of the 13 principles of the Rambam is that God does not have a body. And this became, anybody today who thinks God has a body, we think they're crazy. Everybody understands God doesn't have a body. But we know there were people who felt that God had a body. And the Rambam says that you can be the greatest person in the world. You can be a tzaddik and give tzedakah and are kind and compassionate and always helpful to people. But if you have to believe that God has a body, you're going to lose your share in the world to come. It's a pretty harsh statement, because the person is flawed in his fundamental of understanding of God. He cannot enter the world to come. He cannot come close to God. He totally misunderstands God. And the Ravid gets very upset. And the Ravid said, Mr. Rambam, there are people greater than you. A famous Ravid in Hilchot Teshuva, there are people greater than you who think that Tovim Ugdolim, better and greater than you, who think that God has a body based on what the verses in the Torah says. It seems to say in the body, Yad Chazaka, God has a strong arm, Einei Hashem Lekacha, the eyes of God, all over the place. So of course the Rambam interprets them and asks their anthropomorphism, they're just our way of being able to relate to God. But of course, God has no feelings, God has no body, etc. So, okay, but there's good reason. There's lots of Talmudic passages and lots of verses in the Torah that would seem to say that God has a body or physical feature, something that's very strange for us and something we generally don't accept. That view of the Rambam has been widely accepted. But I think you can really take another approach, and that's the idea that everything, we've mentioned this, everything the Torah tells us about God is about us. So when the Torah is saying that God can get angry and then you can appease God, so that's telling us about how we're supposed to act. Now, the Gemara goes on to say that God does get angry. That's what the Gemara says. God gets angry. He gets angry for like a mini, mini, mini second. So, the Gemara wants to know that's, and if you can figure out when God gets angry, if you can mark that time that God gets angry, you can do tremendous harm. And the Gemara said, had Bilam managed to put his curses at a time when God got angry, lo nishtarus misoneim shel Yisrael, there would have been nobody left of the enemies of Israel. And whenever the Talmud uses the expression enemies of Israel, it's always a euphemism. It means us as the Jewish people. The Talmud didn't want to say there would be no Jews left in the world, so they say there'd be no enemies of the Jewish people left. But that's what it says in the Talmud right after this, that had Bilam managed to time the anger of God that split second, that would have been the end of the Jewish people. But the Gemara says God was very nice, and God decided not to get angry when Bilam is alive, because he was afraid of this. And so God had a kiviyachlo, God had to restrain himself. And God had to say during the X number of years that Bilam is alive, and he never knows when Bilam is going to curse the Jewish people. Of course, we understand why Bilam wants to curse the Jewish people. He knows this too, presumably, that there are times that God gets angry, and he's hoping to time it, and he missed, because God did a tremendous act of kindness that he never got angry. This also can be a message for us. Yes, everybody can get angry, but we know that anger is one of the two traits, anger and humility, are the two traits that the Rambam says, the same Rambam, you shouldn't use the golden mean. The Rambam says, you know, you shouldn't spend too much money, but you shouldn't be too cheap. A person, you shouldn't be too happy-go-lucky, but you shouldn't be all depressed. You shouldn't be a glutton, but you shouldn't be an ascetic either. You have to always follow the middle path. But when it comes to anger, There's no middle path. You should never get angry. Never, ever, ever get angry. And when you're allowed to get angry, in theory, just get the fake anger so people, you know, respond. But you're never allowed to get anger. And the same thing to be humble. Ma'od, ma'od, habishvavro. Very, very much. We discussed that a number of weeks ago. And Moshe Rabbeinu, anaf mikol adam. So those are the traits that we should never have. And I think that's what the Gemara is saying. That, sometimes you get angry. There's a time for anger. But really, God restrains himself, or the ideal is to restrain ourselves and never get angry, because we know, what the Gemara says, in a split second, Bilaam could have killed, could have wiped out the entire Jewish people. It's like an amazing, amazing passage of our sages. It's hard to believe they meant it in a literal sense. But we all know what a person can do in a split second of anger. You can ruin your whole life, and you make one really, really stupid decision or action in a fit of rage, and it can come back to haunt your life. And I think that's what the Gemara is saying, Gus. When somebody's angry, don't entice them. Don't try to talk to them. Make the situation a lot worse. This Talmudic passage about you shouldn't try to appease people when they're angry, is said immediately after the Talmudic passage, which we discussed a number of weeks ago, that God prays every day. My house is a Beit Tefillah L'Chol Amim, Beit Tefillati, where God prays. And of course, what do you mean God prays? It's also heretical, because we only pray if we need things. So what do you mean? How can God need something? So the idea is that it's teaching man how man has to act, and man has to pray, and man shouldn't get angry. And perhaps you have a split second. There may be in one millionth of a time you can get angry. Okay, it's not realistic for a human being to never get angry. So the Gemara says that about God, to teach us that even God, occasionally gets angry, because it's not realistic to expect somebody to never display anger. Even God couldn't withhold himself, so to speak. But he knew that in time of Bilaam, it would be too dangerous if he ever had a moment of anger, because if Bilaam timed it, that's it. And then I think it's an amazing, amazing Gemara. Okay, then the Gemara continues, or the Mishnah continues, Al tenachmenu b'sheh shemeito mutalafanav. Don't try to comfort them when the person is when the dead body is before them. So this, of course, is a halakhic expression from the third chapter in Masechet Brachot, that mishemeito mutalafanav, when a dead body, when a person is an oning, between the death and the burial, they're patur from Kriyat Shema. They don't have to daven. There's actually a machloket. I don't know if people are so aware of this. I think most people know that when somebody dies, you're not allowed to daven. You're not allowed to make a bracha. You're not allowed to do mitzvot. And again, as we're Soloveitchik explained, mitzvot bespeak of a relationship between God and the Jewish people. Your relationship to God. You have a personal relationship with God. You thank him, you get up in the morning, you go through a routine. There's certain things you do to acknowledge our relationship with God. And when a relative dies, that relationship is broken. It would be unbecoming to try to say you can have a relationship with God. There's anger, there's upset, there's sadness, and that's not the time. Only at the time after burial, slowly the process begins of the redeveloping that relationship with God. The mourner is quiet. People come, the Shiva, the Shloshim, Yodei Chodesh. You slowly develop that relationship. But you can't, B'Sheh Shemeito Mutal Lefanav, you can't do any mitzvot. That's a debate whether you're not allowed to. That's the way we hold, you're not allowed to. But I think Rashi is the one who said you're not allowed to, and Tosfot's the one who said you don't have to. You're patur from mitzvot. But if you want to do, in other words, the Torah exempts you. It's too hard to do mitzvot. But if you want to, it's a very interesting philosophical argument. You're not allowed to do mitzvot, or you can do mitzvot, or you don't have to do mitzvot. Whatever the case may be, a person at that point cannot accept any comfort. And to try to comfort somebody when Shabbat Shemeto Mutal Lefanav, the dead body's right before them, not necessarily literal, but also unfortunately literal. That is not the time for comfort. and that you're not allowed to offer comfort at that moment. And it will most likely get the person even more upset. We know, unfortunately, I mean, my father was a rabbi for over 50 years, and I many funerals that I went to, and he would always towards the end of the funeral, he would always talk to people how to act in a shiva house. People often they come in, they make silly comments, even if they aren't silly. That happens too, unfortunately. They socialize, eat breakfast, and whatever. He was against that whole thing. You know, the mourners feel they have to serve breakfast. Whatever. That's a whole other discussion. But very often people have well-meaning comments, but they're just totally inappropriate. And you have to learn. There's a science how to pay a shiva visit. That's why the halakha states you shouldn't say anything until the mourner talks to you. You don't talk to them. You're not allowed to talk to them. It's very hard sometimes. I'm in the house of mourning and the mourner doesn't talk to you. You feel strange, but that's the halakha, because psychologically that's very important. If you want to offer for comfort, you have to let the mourner initiate the discussion. So that I think we all know, but it's important. That's what the Mishnah here is stressing. That is not the time to offer any comfort. Now, it's fascinating. The Bar Tanura derives this. He quotes a rabbinic teaching that when God destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, or God allowed the Beit HaMikdash to be destroyed, the angels came to God and tried to comfort him. Very appropriate for this week. And they tried, this is Shabbos Nachamu, Nachem. We offer comfort. So we think of offering comfort to the Jewish people. But God also needs comfort. Imo Anochi Betzara, again, this anachronistic anthropomorphism that God needs comfort. But it sounds very, it's a beautiful idea that God suffers. God, purpose of creation was to develop a relationship with all of humanity, with Adam HaRishon. That didn't work so well. So eventually only he developed a special relationship with only the Jewish people. And the rest of the world also, of course, can have a relationship with God. It's a different type of a relationship. But God created the world. When Rashi says Yom HaShishi, that's 6th day, that God said, if you accept the Torah on the 6th day, that's great. What is that teaching us? That God didn't create a world for his glory. He didn't need it. He created a world so he can create people, B'Tselem Elohim, who are like him, who copy him, who follow his midot. And he develops a special type of a relationship with them. So when we suffer, he suffers. So even though, so God allowed the Beit HaMikdash, the angels came to God and said to comfort him. And God said, now is not the time to comfort. The B'Shesh Shemeto Muta Lefana, dispersion, exile, suffering, not time for comfort. What's, I don't know, scary, sad, amazing, is it doesn't say when is the time to offer God comfort. Like in other words, doesn't say leave me alone for a week, a month, a year, right? Obviously time, that's not the idea, but it's sort of an idea. When is God comforted? So probably God is comforted when things are going well from the Jewish people. The creation of the state of Israel offers comfort to the Jewish people and offers comfort to God. Again, this dual relationship, whatever happens to God, God's feelings are expressed through mankind. We have to, and how we feel, God feels the same way. Especially, it's a beautiful idea. However, you want to interpret it, the relationship between God and the Jewish people. And then it says, "Al tishalo bishat nidro." Do not ask somebody when he makes a vow. So the simple explanation all the commentaries give is the person says, "I'm never going to talk to him again." And then you go over and say, do you really mean it? When you're going to go business with him, you're going to have to do a deal. What do you mean you're never going to talk to him? I'm never going to go to business with him. Are you sure? Absolutely. I'm sure you don't know what he did to me. Then when he calms down, right, his anger subsides and you calm him down. And then he says, oh my God, that was crazy. I said this ridiculous thing. Yes, I was mad at him, but I didn't mean I'll never go into a business deal with him. So they go to a court. Heter Nedarim, we have this very strange concept that a person can undo a vow. That's really a gift of God. It's what all of tshuva is about. How can we repent? How can Yom Kippur do tshuva? Well, what do you mean? I sinned and now the sin is forgiven. Well, that's crazy. And sometimes the sin turns into a mitzvah. If you do tshuva with such a high level of love and dedication, and you turn your life around completely, the sin becomes an aver. That's like a tremendous act of kindness of God. You have the same thing. A person makes a vow, and he decides he's sorry. I mean, that's not exactly what kol nidre. It's sort of what kol nidre is, but we're not going to go into kol nidre now. And that's why it created a lot of tension. And Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, when he became it's amazing. Can you imagine the rabbi coming to shul and abolishing kol nidre? So that lasted for 1 year. And they had the riot in shul, and that was it. Kol nidre was put back. Certain things, no matter how great the rabbi is, there's nothing you can do about it, because there was this fear, our Jews don't keep their vows. You know, kol nidre, we just get rid of all their vows. We don't take our commitments seriously. That's not its meaning, but that's not important. But we do have a concept. It's true. It is a little bit true. We can undo the vow, but you need a reason. So you have to go explain, I didn't really mean it. The problem is if the person, if you ask them and he said, yes, I mean it, then they can't use that as an excuse. In other words, the rabbis need an excuse. They need some, what we call a petah. They need an opening to declare that the vow you gave, you didn't really mean it, you didn't understand. Yes, the vow is good, but the vow doesn't apply over here. But if you specifically say the vow applies over here, then you're in trouble. Now, this whole concept, they're saying this tremendous act of chesed, that's what the Mishnah says. Heter nedarim porchim ba'avir. It's a beautiful expression. The annulment of vows is flying in the wind. Porchim ba'avir. Ve'en lehem mamash she'ismoch. But there's nothing to lean on. There's no verse in the Torah. The Torah is so clear that midvar sheker tircha motzitz v'techa tishmor. You have to run away from a lie. You have to keep the words you say over and over. The Torah emphasizes the importance of our speech. Last 2 weeks ago, Sparshas, Matot, in the beginning, the importance of how we speak and what we say, and especially leaders. I remember as my sister who told me this many years ago, I don't even know if she remembers telling me this, but I think she was giving a Dvar Torah once, and she quoted how the Chatam Sofer, I believe, says that the Roshei Matot, the Parsha of keeping our word, was given to the Roshei Matot, to the leaders of the Jewish people. Well, why? It applied to everybody. Everybody has to keep their word. No one can just ignore their vows. But yet, it's the leaders who are more likely to say things that aren't true. It's leaders who are more likely not to keep their vows. We know how true that is and how sad that is. And that's why only the cream of the crop should be going into politics. But that's a whole other problem we have. It's a tragic problem we have. Really, leaders, it's more important the leader not lie. And unfortunately, we all expect our leaders to lie. It's a terrible thing. But anyway, but sometimes you can undo. God gave a tremendous act of chesed, but you have to know how to do it and when to do it. So don't, when somebody says a vow, it obviously ties into the anger. Somebody says a vow, don't ask him too many questions. Now, what does the Bartholomew say? How do we know this? This week's Parsha, Parsha Rashavua. Bet Hanan al Hashem Beitei Limor. I cried to God, and the Medrash said Moshe pleaded, I don't know, 518 times, I think, the Gematria of Bet Hanan. You know, and God finally told him enough is enough, but Moshe waited. And Moshe, we don't see Moshe pleading after Chet HaMeraglim. I can't go into Israel, right? That happened a few months earlier, right? The Chet HaMeraglim happened, whatever, 6 months before Moshe dies. It's it's hard for us to imagine, you know, the 40 years in the desert, but really everything happens in the first year and in the last year. And the hitting of the rock is and in the last year, right after Miriam dies. And the water went away, the Medrash says. So that's Moshe doesn't plead with God. He didn't say anything. Because at that moment, God was angry at Moshe. And he would have said, absolutely, you can't go to land of Israel. So Moshe waited. It's also a beautiful idea. So Moshe waited. You have to know when to approach God. And he waited and he waited. And then, okay, he's dying he's supposed to die in a month. Parsha Dvarim and Sefer Dvarim. So now God, you know what? Come on, you know, that was, you can forgive. We're here, we're about to go to the land, we're going to conquer the land, it's going to be wonderful, we're going to set up an ethical state, a moral state, a wonderful state. I can go in, even if we need a new leader, even if we need a military leader, we need a Yoshua type to conquer the land. He's a military expert. He fought Amalek. I'm happy to go in as a retired general. I'm the leader. I'm retired. And I go in together. And God, of course, said no. Eventually, and actually, he told Moshe to be quiet. As the Medrash says, I've had a Ravla. It's enough already. Enough already. And this actually, I think, ties into the beautiful idea that the Ramban expresses, we mentioned in the past, that prayer is not an obligation. Only the Rambam is really of the view that prayer is a daily obligation. Everybody else says we only pray in times of need. Of course, Rav Soloveitchik explained that we always have needs, so if we don't realize it, even the Ramban would agree. But we all have needs. In other words, even the Rambam agrees. It's not that we pray every day because we have to pray. It's that every day we have needs, even if you don't realize it. And the Ramban would say, only if you realize you have needs, you have to pray. But the Ramban fundamentally says prayer is not an obligation. We're not obligated to pray. Anyway, I'm obligated to say I want to be healthy. I'm obligated to say I want to be wealthy. I'm obligated to say I want peace. Well, that's what do you mean you're obligated? I don't want to pray. I don't want peace. I don't feel that I want to do that. It's not an obligation. It's that God is really, really kind to us, and God allows us to pray to him. It's an act of chesed. You have to three times a day bang on God's door and chuck him a china and drive him nuts. I went over and over every single day the same things. Enough already. So God doesn't say that to us. He said it to Moshe Rabbeinu. He said, Moshe Rabbeinu, enough already. But I think that's the exception. It also teaches us that God, Moshe waited, but God didn't listen. God didn't listen to that, but he always listens to us. He doesn't tell us to be quiet, not to pray, except on Tisha B'Av. Satam Tivilati, it says in Eicha, God doesn't hear our prayers. But it's interesting, right? It's not really a day. We still daven, of course, on Tisha B'Av, but it's not really a day of prayer. It's a day of mourning. But it's a day we acknowledge that God doesn't hear our prayers. But otherwise, God always hears our prayers. So that we also, Moshe was very smart, so to speak. But we have that same concept by Yaakov Avinu and by Moshe Rabbeinu. You should only give mussar to people. You want to tell your children. I mean, that's the example by Yaakov Avinu. But you want to tell people what to do. Wait till you're on your deathbed, because they're much more likely to listen. Rashi gives four reasons, or quotes four reasons, right? People, if you tell people too early, you have to have the right time. And when a person is elderly and dying, their children are more likely to listen. I don't know. I'm not saying put on guilt. That's not what we're talking about. That's not how Rashi explains it, the idea that we should make them feel all guilty. The idea is that there's a proper time for everything, and people are more susceptible. I know for when somebody is sitting Shiva, they're much more open to learning. I mean, especially non-observant Jews. I can, the years I served as a rabbi, there's no doubt the most important thing a rabbi does is comforting mourners. Absolutely no doubt. Anything the rabbi, and that's very private, people don't know about it, but the rabbi, the amount of time is spending time with the family and helping them, and especially dealing with non-observant Jews, it's a tremendous opportunity. They open up and they want to learn more, and they see the beauty of our tradition. I'm sure you all know of people who started coming to shul only because they had to say Kaddish, while many stopped when the 11 months is over, many continue or continue on an occasional basis. So there is something to timing. The timing has to be right for everything. That's where it's really the teaching of this Mishnah is. The right thing and the wrong timing is counterproductive, but the right thing and the right timing is wonderful. And the right time to give people, mussar is the end of your career. When a person's or by Yaakov Avinu on his deathbed, and that of course ties into Midrash. How do you know when you're going to die? So we don't. But that's what Yaakov Avinu prayed, that God should give him the ability to know when he's going to die. That's the Midrash, that until that, no one got sick in the Torah. They just all died. They sneezed, right? That's how the Midrash said. That's why you wish somebody long life when they sneeze, because when they sneeze, that used to mean they would die. Now, Baruch Hashem, usually it doesn't mean that. So Yaakov Avinu prayed that he should get sick. We don't like to get sick, really, but it shouldn't be too terrible a sickness, but it gave Yaakov an opportunity to prepare for his death himself personally, and to prepare a message for his children. And Moshe Rabbeinu has the same thing. Bezot HaBracha. Moshe Rabbeinu knew his God gave him that wonderful gift that he told him when he was going to die, so he could prepare not only himself personally, but prepare the next generation. That's what the entire book of Dvarim is about, is the last 5 weeks of Moshe's life, preparing for the next generation. So the timing is crucial, of course. We all know this. Timing is everything, as they say. And the last teaching in the Mishnah, Al tishtadel liroto b'shat kalkalo. Do not try to see him in a time of disgrace, where he's embarrassed. He's kilkul. It's all broken. You know, you look away. When someone's going through a tough time, don't walk over them. It's very, very embarrassing. Now, the Bartanur, the classical commentators, explain it as sin. In other words, when somebody is sinning, stay away. Don't go near them. It's very embarrassing. It's very embarrassing. And they quote, "We also know this from God." How do we know this from God? Because God. When does God appear in the first sin in the Torah? God, Adam and Eve eat in the Garden of Eden, and God says, "What did you do?" Right? God didn't even lambast them, right? The best way to get somebody to improve is let them come up with their own ideas, right? Everybody, if you're like a good CEO and you're running a company, instead of imposing your views, so sometimes that works in the modern economy. Okay, whatever. But ideally, it's much better. You get buy-in. Buy-in's always much better. How do you get buy-in? You get buy-in by letting other people think of the idea. Think, what did it's their idea, right? The brilliant person knows how to take their idea and have other people think, they thought of their own. You ask leading questions, you have the person come up with their idea. So God didn't start lambasting Adam and Eve. He asked them a question: "Where are you? What did you do? What happened?" It's just engaged in conversation. And then they realize on their own. That's much better. They realize they sinned on their own than you tell them you sinned. That's also we have to learn from God. But of course, that you don't just, "What you did this terrible." Engage them, ask them questions, and let them realize their sin. But Bartanur points out, when does God do? That's only after he dresses them. He dresses them. Only after, you know, they get clothes. We discussed, because in the ideal world, in Gan Eden, there's no difference between the physical and the spiritual world. I mentioned also talking a lot on mourning, but that's why a mourner rips their clothes, right? Because while we're alive, in the ideal world, the physical and the spiritual go together. You walk around naked. Well, why not? That's how God created us. That's how it's meant to be in Gan Eden. But of course, once we sin, there was a break between the physical, and we have to cover up our physical bodies. But once a person dies and they go back to sort of all spiritual world, so the mourner rips their clothes to symbolize that, to symbolize the end of the physical. There's just the spiritual, only the soul is left. So that's, we don't need clothes anymore. Obviously, we're not going to, so we symbolically rip our clothes. That's the real, I think that's the real basis for the halacha that we have, that one has to tear kriya. But God first let them, by Yavishatam, they themselves felt the need to dress themselves, to cover themselves up, because they were embarrassed, so to speak. And then God approached them. So that's how the Mepharshim explained that. Of course, we learn from God himself. You shouldn't see somebody literally, like you shouldn't see them when they're naked. That's really God, right? You should let them cover up, and then you can approach them. But of course, it has a much broader application. And it doesn't, of course, only apply to people who sin. Right, it applies whenever someone's going through a very tough time. You don't walk over to them. That's not the time. I mean, maybe their husband or wife or their kids, depending on the situation. But you have to give people space. They're very embarrassed. They're in a public area and something's happened. You know, the kid is running through the store. I don't know if this is a great example. And it's all, you know, insane, and they can't control the kids. Don't go there. Don't walk by and watch how the parents are struggling, unless you want to help the parents. But that's not the time to go by, to give sort of a very mundane other type of example. But the to take this a step further, you don't, right? If we're talking on sin, you don't want to see a person. Bishat kil koto is when the time he sins, you don't want to, the person embarrassed. So that's a very important idea. We don't want to embarrass a sinner. One could easily say, a sinner. Of course we want to embarrass him. As a matter of fact, the halacha, we know how terrible it is to embarrass somebody in public. Everybody knows that the Talmud says one who embarrasses a person in public loses their share in the world to come. It doesn't mean if you did it once in your life. I don't feel that there's anybody here who's never, unfortunately, embarrassed. Maybe there are, but to never embarrass somebody in public means on a regular basis, right? Whenever the Gemara says things like that, you do this, you're promised this reward. If you do that, you're promised this sin, this punishment. I don't think it means for sure by sin, but even by means. But I don't think it means you did it once in your life. It means you're habitual in this area. One who has no shame to use with it, and he's constantly embarrassing people, that person will lose their share in the world to come. But that halacha, that you're not allowed to embarrass people, is said in the Torah by a sinner. The person that's in chapter 19 in Kedoshim, and Torah says, Hochiach tochiach et amitecha. You have to give rebuke to your neighbor. What's the rest of the pasuk? Now I don't have it in front of me. Lo tisa alav chet. You shouldn't carry a sin upon him. And the Gemara derived that you have to rebuke the person, but if you embarrass him, you're sinning. You're not to embarrass a sinner. The point is not to show him what he did wrong, to tell him how terrible he is. The point is to get him to improve. This is a part of the very often methodology of the Torah, where the Torah always puts things where we least expect them, right? So, okay, don't embarrass a regular person, great, but a sinner, of course I can embarrass them, right? Don't bury, you have to bury a regular person right away, of course, but a convicted murderer? No. So where does the Torah teach us that you have to bury a person, right? A convicted murderer, right? That's the parsha of burial is after the court puts to death this person. You can't let his body lie on that. The Torah does that all the time. Where are the laws of how a husband has to treat his wife? By a slave, right? The Torah always puts mitzvot where you least expect them. It's a kal vachomer. If you have to do the mitzvot here, how much more so do you have to do it in the regular case? So you can't embarrass a sinner. How much more so can't you embarrass someone who isn't a sinner? That you'll find throughout the Torah. Just pick it up all the time. And the mitzvot, always look at the context of the mitzvot. Often the context teaches us about as much about the mitzvah as the mitzvah itself. It's also, I like to point out that the mitzvah, right, not to embarrass somebody, not to make them feel bad, is said in the context of a sinner, because immediately before it says that, to rebuke the person, right? We all know that. We can't ignore sin. We're supposed to tell person, show them why they're doing wrong, hopefully engage them in conversation so they on themselves will realize what they're doing wrong, but you can't just let it slide. We don't have mind your own business. So it's true on a practical level, the halacha understood that often you have to mind your own business. The halakha says the same way it's a mitzvah to engage in conversation and rebuke someone who might listen, it's a mitzvah to keep your mouth shut when they're not going to listen. That's the whole theme of the Mishnah, know when to speak and when not to speak. That's even though it's the right thing to do. You want to comfort somebody, you want to tell them not to be angry, it's the right thing, but at the wrong time, it's not going to work. So if you tell somebody, what are you driving on Shabbos? You're going to think you're crazy. What am I driving on Shabbos? Invite them to a Friday night meal, and after 3 years, maybe they'll stop driving, you know, I don't know. But you have to do it in a very in a sensible way. So the Gemara, so you have to rebuke people if it has a possibility of working. The fact that we don't rebuke people is a practical thing. It's not going to work. It may be counterproductive in our society. It usually will be counterproductive. 98% of the cases will be counterproductive. But theoretically, conceptually, of course, we don't mind your own business. If somebody's doing something wrong, we have to try to get them to do what's right. Kol Yisrael Ravim Zeh B'Zeh. We're all in it together. And it's not just Jew. We're the whole world. We're all in the same boat. We're all together. We're living in a global Village Day, you know, all the global warming, whatever, all the issues in the world and our political discourse, these are issues that affect the whole world. So we can't sit by quietly, even though sometimes in practice you have no choice. But we'd like to note that the expression of the Torah to rebuke somebody is hochiach, tochiach. The hochiach in Hebrew means to prove to them. You don't go over and say what you're doing is wrong. You have to prove to them. You have to prove to them what they're doing wrong. It's not a, why should I keep Shabbos? What normal person? Well, I can't turn on a light on Shabbos. I can't get in my car. What do you mean? If Shabbos is a family day and my grandmother lives like 10 miles away, I can't walk. Of course, on Shabbos, I'm going to get in the car and visit my grandmother. So you have to talk about, you have to prove to them. You can't tell them. Hochiach, tochiach. And the Torah, again, on the double language, the Torah tells us that's how you rebuke somebody. It's not rebuke. You try to demonstrate to them why mitzvot are beautiful and wonderful. If you can, it's not going to work. But that's, we've discussed many, many times. If you're honest and nice, that's what works, right? To get other people to get engaged in mitzvot, that's, you have to be a role model, but you have to do what we can. But it's not enough to say, and this is true for anybody, teachers, all the time, parents, you know, yes, often people in authority, we're talking to CEO before, people in authority can establish rules, but usually that's not the smart thing to do. Usually you have to explain to them why the rules make sense. And that's when you're going to get buy-in. Okay, that's basically some thoughts on this Mishnah. And then unless anybody has any questions I'd like to ask now, I'm happy. I'll move on to the next Mishnah. Just let me quickly see if anybody put anything in the chat box. No coming was no burial. So Beitar, right, that's correct. The Harugei Beitar, that's one of the reasons of Tu B'Av, I believe. The Harugei Beitar were buried on the 15th of Av tomorrow, the happiest day of the year. Right, the Yom Kippur, that's for another shir. Anali Bowser Yom Kippur, I'll try to get to at the end. Embarrassing the same person is not the same as rebuking them when it's done in a constructive way. That is often correct, but often it's not correct. In other words, I think it depends on the situation. And really what the Mishnah is saying is use our own judgment. Right? We can't give exact rules, but what the Mishnah says is Al tishtadel liroto b'shal kal kamto. Don't try and see him. Even that word try, right? In other words, usually we don't, the Bartanura, I wouldn't say it's about sin. I would have interpreted in general. Person's going through a difficult time. We have to figure out when they need their own space and it's embarrassing. But the Bartanura interprets it as when a person sins, that's not the time to go over to them. You have to wait till after the sin. God allowed Adam and Eve to cover themselves up. You don't go in immediately. Just like Yaakov Avinu didn't rebuke immediately, even by Shimon and Levi. Yes, they had an immediate discussion. That's normal. But Yaakov really waited to give his message till his deathbed. Often you have to know when to regret. It's a very fine line, but correct. And that's the whole point of what the Gemara says. You're not allowed to embarrass when you are rebuking them. You must. The halakha demands we distinguish between rebuke and embarrassment. And if our rebuke will cause embarrassment, you're not allowed to do it. Now, again, halakhically, there are certain exceptions. Like we're discussing broad concept. Yes, let's say a man won't give his wife a get. And it's terrible. And we know he's really wrong. So that probably is a time you're allowed to embarrass somebody. There are times in life. There are exceptions to the rule. Just like Lashon Hara, you're obligated to talk Lashon Hara in a court. But generally, that the law is very clear that you're not allowed, you rebuke, but don't embarrass. And that's it's in the same pasuk, in the exact same pasuk in chapter 19. Yes, you have to stop them. That's very also, yes, if somebody is committing a sin or there's going to be harm to a third party, then you have to intercede. Yes, very good. We know that's one of the reasons to talk Lashon Hara. If somebody's going to harm somebody else, so yes, the victim's rights trumps the rights of the perpetrator. So that's an important point. So if the perpetrator is going to embarrass somebody, and the only way to stop, or if the only way to stop the embarrassment, or the only way to stop A hurting B is to embarrass A, then you, of course you do that. But I was talking more, it's like a one-on-one. It's not impacting on others. That's why in the court of law, you talk lashon hara. Whenever you have to help the victim, then we can't worry about the embarrassment of, you know, the person who is committing the wrong. Although I think even there, you know, even a criminal who is convicted is entitled to rights. We know that one of the applications of the verse, to love your neighbor as yourself, it's an amazing application. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, v'apta l'reacha, l'reacha, l'reacha. You have to love your neighbor, excuse me. So one of the things the Gemara says, the application of that pasuk is, b'ror lo mita yafeh, give him a pleasant death. The court has to kill somebody, but you can't make him suffer more than he has to suffer. You can't do any more. Give him a pleasant death. I mean, it's almost an oxymoron, but that's what the Gemara says, to display our love of ahava towards reyacha, kamocha, is that even the person who we have to kill, which of course was rarely done, we know it was in practice, it was almost never done, still it has to be done in a way that is not going to be cruel to him. So even when a person's a convicted murderer, that's what, as we said, that's the laws of burial are set in Torah by a convicted murderer. So yes, that may be embarrassing, we're going to kill him. It may be terrible, and then what the family's going to suffer and the terrible thing. It's true, but sometimes we have no choice, the victim. So I was talking abstractly, you know, normally on a one-to-one, somebody doesn't keep shower, somebody's doing wrong something in school. So then you have to be very careful not to embarrass, right? A teacher who embarrasses a student has lost that student probably for life. And the damage can be terrible sometimes. Sometimes kids will tell you, you know, they went off the derech, to use that expression, whatever. Sometimes because a teacher made an embarrassing comment. It's unbelievable how terrible it can be. But yes, unfortunately, at times we have to. Okay, let's begin the next Mishnah. It's one expects the beautiful teaching of Rav Kook, at least. Shmuel HaKatan Omer. Shmuel, the small one. So, by the way, I believe this is his own only teaching. We have very few teaching, but he's very well known. Shmuel HaKatan Omer, bin folei bechal tismach. When your enemy falls, do not be happy. Ubikishlo al tagel libecha. And when he stumbles, kishalon, he stumbles. So the Malbim explains, being fall is physical harm. Your enemy is destroyed. Literally, he died. You defeat him in battle, whatever you want to take that example. Kishlo means a spiritual falling. He has a, you know, the rabbi sinned and he, you know, you didn't like him, whatever. And then he has a fall from grace. But one is physical and spiritual. So first of all, it's just fascinating. But my name is Shmuel HaKatan Omer. This is not Shmuel HaKatan. It's Mishlei. This is this Mishnah is Shmuel HaKatan. And then they quote the second passage, Pen Yir Hashem Rabbeinav, lest God will see. God will see your rejoicing over the fall of your enemy. Beishim Yelav Apo, and then he'll get angry at you. So all Shmuel HaKatan does is quote a verse. That's a fact. We don't have this anywhere else that I can think of in the entire like corpus of the Mishnah. Shmuel said, what do you mean Shmuel said? Mishlei said, Shlomo HaMelech is the one who said it. But we know in life, things become famous through other things. Who learns Mishlei? How many people know? How many psukim in Mishlei can you quote by heart? Right? But everybody knows this pasuk. They may not even know it's in Mishlei. Because Shmuel HaKatan made it famous. But it's just, it's obvious, but it's a beautiful idea that the Mishnah is saying, what did Shmuel HaKatan do? All Shmuel HaKatan did is quote a verse in Chumash, or not in Tanakh. And often that's the most effective thing. Often you'll hear, I didn't do anything. I just quoted what it says. I just put two and two together. I quoted a Rambam, and I quoted a Gemara, and I quoted a Pasuk. I didn't do anything. But you have to know which Rambam to quote with which Pasuk, whatever. You have to know which things to quote. That's the brilliance. Shmuel HaKatan felt it's very important. Shmuel HaKatan is living in the generation after the destruction of the temple. He's a generation in Yavneh. with Rabban Gamliel, all the famous people in Yavne, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Elazar Hagadol, Rabbi Elazar Ben Azariah. I mean, it lasted, the time in Yavne was sort of more than one generation, but the younger, the older rabbis there, but that's the generation of Shmuel HaKatan. So I don't know if you want to give it a historical explanation that even when the Romans will fall, they hadn't fallen yet, but when the Romans will fall, you should retreat. But we normally don't look to it historically, although that's often adds a layer of meaning. So Shmuel HaKatan says, we'll get to why he's called Shmuel HaKatan maybe next week, but I just want to discuss the one beautiful concept, and we'll see how much time we have left. Rav Kook. So I mentioned that Shmuel HaKatan lived during the generation of Yavne, the time after the Beit HaMikdash, and Rabban Gamliel is a very strong will, very important Nasi, who, by the way, did embarrass people. He embarrassed his brother-in-law, Rabbi Elazar HaGadol. He put him into cherem, and that whole story of Tanur Shalachnai is a very problematic story. I mentioned the story's in the context. It's on the same page. You have to turn the page, but it's the same discussion of the Gemara about not embarrassing people. That's on the same page. Gemara says not to embarrass people not to oppress people. And it's in that context that the famous story of the fight with Rabbi Elazar, he proved that he was right. And the rabbi said, Rabbi Yeshua says, Torah is not in heaven. And they put Rabbi Elazar HaGadol, they excommunicated him, Rabbi Gamliel. And the end of the story is a terrible tragedy happens, and Rabbi Gamliel ended up dying because of that. The end of the story makes clear that the Talmudic editors were very, very, very critical of the rabbinic leadership, how the way they treated Rabbi Elazar HaGadol. We mentioned that another occasion, but it's an important point. So Rabban Gamliel was the leader that was needed at the time. We needed a strong-willed leader. Sometimes you make a mistake. Strong-willed leaders, they went overboard. In the generation after the destruction of the temple, and the Jewish people are rife with strife and fighting and sinat chinam and argument, Rabban Gamliel was the one who said the halacha must be like Beit Hillel, even though his family followed Beit Shammai often. But he understood we need to unify the people. And that's why he took such a strong position on this. And that's why he embarrassed Rabbi Yoshua. That's the more famous story. I don't know why I started with Rabbi Elazar Gadol. The more famous story made Rabbi Yoshua come on Yom Kippur, and they impeached him over it. They impeached him. He made him stand up in the Beit Midrash because he disagreed. It wasn't really right. He went too far. I mean, it's clear it wasn't right. But on the other hand, it was just an extension of what was right. That was the leader who was needed, a strong leader at this very crucial time in Jewish history. But yet, okay, he's a human being. He went a little too far occasionally. So the Gemara says, but to get back, Rabban Gamliel said, who knows how to compare to compose a prayer for our enemies? And that's Bilamal Shinim. We know how many blessings are in the Shemona Esrei, how many blessings are in 18 blessings? 19, right? Of course, there are 19 blessings in the 18 blessings. Because Bilamal Shinim al titikva, we should have no mercy on our enemies, right? We should have no mercy on our enemies. Al titikva, v'chol erishak v'rekadvei, we should uproot hatred, ta'aker, tishaber, and ben nosach ashkenaz, a very harsh, very negative, prayer. We say it three times a day. So Rabban Gamliel said, who is there who knows how to compose this prayer? I don't know. Why didn't Rabban Gamliel know? He would be good at it. And the Lord says, Shmuel HaKatan. Shmuel HaKatan says, I know. And Shmuel HaKatan is the one who composes Bilamal Shinim. Very nice. So Rav Kook has a beautiful explanation. Maybe some of you have heard it before. Maybe it's said in other like people's name. Says that only a person who loves the enemy can write a prayer of hate against the enemy, right? Once, had Rabban Gamliel written a prayer against the enemies, boy, he would have let them have it. But he would have let them have it more than is necessary. Only someone who's compassionate towards the enemy can write, yes, we have Paul de Meir's famous line, we can perhaps forgive the Arabs for killing Jews, but we can't forgive them for making us kill Arabs. You know, it's the same idea. So we care about our enemies, right? We're very sad, right? We take out the wine and the Esser Makwa. Yes, the Egyptians had a drama. We're not happy about it. It would have been better had the situation turned out very differently. So only a Shmuel HaKatan, who has been Folei Becha Al Tismach, do not be happy, who had that joy, I'm sorry, had that pain when the enemy suffered, even if this suffering was necessary and they deserved it and we have no choice, still only somebody like that can compose a prayer of hatred. It's such, I think it's such a beautiful idea. So that's why they go, who can go? Who would, no, you need the right personality. And that's, of course, this is applied, have to apply in all areas of life. You need the right personality. You need a teacher to be super compassionate, right? In order to give, you know, proper discipline, you have to be super compassionate on people. You always need, whenever you're doing somebody, right? The person who can display anger is the person who never gets angry, right? It's only, it has to come from that angle. It's kind of the court of the halakha that, you know, we've mentioned in a number of times that the halakha that if there's a person loading an animal or unloading an animal, so we always have to help the person unloading the animal because we care about the animals. Yes, you can use the animal for a burden, although not too much, but still, given a choice, I'm going to help you unload first, and then I'm going to help the person load. Unless the person who is loading the animal, you hate him. He's your enemy. You can't stand him. And the person who's unloading is your best friend. Ah, then I duck. I have to help my enemy load the animal because it's more important. I develop feelings of compassion toward my enemy. We all know our cognitive dissonance that by helping people, the actions mold our character. That's the theme of the Sefer HaKinuch. So by helping my enemy, he's gonna, how can I hate you? You're so nice to me, right? You disarm that person. So the halakha there reverses itself because it's very important. So it's very, this whole idea that, that's why, what is, Shimon Katan didn't say anything. He just quoted a pasuk in Mishlei. That was his life. And that's it. Okay, it's getting, it's, you know, 10:27. So just let's do a quick review. So we discussed Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, right? There are two different worlds. One have nothing to do with the other. So you can have greatness in one world that doesn't, is greater than the whole other world, and greatness in another area in this world that's greater than the whole other world. The two greatnesses have nothing to do with each other because one is a physical or one is a spiritual world of reward. And then we discuss the importance of timing. We have to get people not to be angry. Anger is one of the traits. We don't want the middle ground to sometimes get angry. No, we never want to get angry. Even when you're allowed to get angry, you shouldn't get angry. You should feign anger, the anger and how to comfort people and how to, you know, talk to them when they're saying rash statements and how to approach them when they are sinning or they're going through a difficult time. These are all wonderful things, but they have to be done at the proper time and the proper methodology. And you let the person figure out, you don't want to embarrass the sinner. You don't want to, you have to comfort the person in the right way. You have to know what to say in a shiva home, and you have to know, and we love sinners, even if we sometimes have to hurt them or punish them, even if that has to be, still we can't embarrass sinners, because it's a terrible midah of us, and this we'll pick up on this next week, please God. Shmuel HaKatan, don't rejoice the enemy, forget the enemy. What does it say about yourself that you rejoice when somebody else suffers? That's a terrible human quality that the Mishnah is trying to, you know, we'll have to discuss next week, are there exceptions to the rule? But okay, that basically in half a minute, what we discussed. Okay, if there are any questions, please let me know. Otherwise, I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Mr. Zucker, I hope you'll have a question in a moment. And Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag, we're back to our regular schedule. Now, I hope by so many of you were at our Tisha B'Av program. It was our largest program ever that we've done on Zoom. We had over 300 people we reached over 300 people, never had less than 160 people for any of the sessions. So that's unfortunately a meaningful, inspiring day. But like Moshe Rabbeinu prayed that at Chanan, we should see and experience the nechama that has begun already. God has brought us, allowed us to come back to the land of Israel. And that's a partial nechama. We should have a complete nechama. And everybody be well. And please God, continue Sunday morning, I say 11 a.m. with Rabbi Liebtag. Okay, have a Shabbat Shalom. Mr. Zucker. Maybe he's not here. He was here before. I did see him. Okay.
He's muted. I think he's talking, but he has to unmute himself.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, Mr. Zucker. Oh, but you remember the Tvartora? You told me that?
I do not. When did I give that Tvartora?
I don't know, 20 years ago.
Uh-huh. Only you would remember.
You quoted on the it probably was like on in the sisterhood or something at the bait. I don't know what you were.
All chat. Right. I'll have to.
I don't remember the context, but I remember you ran it by me on how the Chatham Sofer says by leaders is especially is when we have to worry, you know.
Okay. Good thought. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways.
I think Mr. Zucker is unmuted now.
Yeah. Okay.
No questions. Just your sure. It was quite inspiring and made me think. And that's what I can
good.
Say.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, so do you have a question or no?
No.
Oh, no questions. Okay. We'll let you off. Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. I enjoy your questions. I enjoy all questions, but I always enjoy your questions.
Thank you. I have questions to myself about my own behavior, but that's another matter.
Yes. We should always question our own behavior. That's... always question, right? Our society doesn't like that. Our society, you know, if you change your mind, that's a sign of weakness in our society. But it's in a Jewish society, it's a sign of great strength. That if you can change your mind is a good thing. It's not, if it's done for a good reason, it's a good thing. All right.
Thank you. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Okay, be well. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Yes.